Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man who has made an outsized contribution to that war through actually several of its very important phases, is our first guest. He is Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He served in the United States Navy for some 36 years in a variety of capacities, rising through the ranks from able-bodied seaman to four-star admiral, and has gone on, I'm very happy to say, since his retirement, to continue his service to our country in a variety of capacities, including as the president of Lyons Associate and also as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. He's one of our favorite guests and always a great contributor to the public policy debate, not only on our program, but through platforms like the Canadian Free Press and others. It's very good to have you with us, Admiral. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes.
Nice to be with you again, Frank, and your listeners.
Thank you, sir. I wanted to start with your take, Admiral, as a man who had considerable experience in your distinguished naval career with NATO, of how the president conducted himself in the course of the just completed summit there, and in particular, the importance, as you see it, sir, of the kinds of increased defense investment by the NATO members that has apparently now been reaffirmed.
I think he was spot on in his comments. And in particular, aside from the utmost requirement to increase their contribution and defense spending to the overall security of Europe, let me say he was spot on in his comments with Angela Merkel of Germany. Why Germany and other NATO members, for that matter, would subject themselves to the control of their energy requirements to a potential enemy? After all, we have to do a reassessment here. It makes absolutely no sense for Europe to subject itself to energy control by the enemy. This is mind-boggling to me.
I couldn't agree more, and it's a topic we're going to return to at the end of this show with David Goldman, Admiral. I wanted to ask you about one other piece of this, Admiral. You have recently been profiled in a new book by our mutual friend, former Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, entitled Oceans Ventured, for your exploits as the commander of a fleet that was sent into the North Sea, close by the Soviet home ports up there, that was an early foray of the Reagan practice of peace through strength. And I would just ask you, Admiral, in addition to trying to reconstitute a NATO defense posture worth a damn, how important is it that we get back in the business of that kind of power projection and exercising thereof?
Well, it's absolutely essential, Frank. And understand, the situations we face today, what President Trump faces, not only against a rejuvenated Russian threat, but also the Chinese threat in the South China Sea. It's not all that different than what President Reagan faced when he took over the presidency in 1981. You've got to collect your resources. Again, we didn't have a 600-ship Navy when we did those forays into the Norwegian Sea and above the Arctic Circle to put Russia on the defensive. They knew they were never going to get to reach a missile launching position. The same type of philosophy and determination must be shown today by our military forces. And we have the capability to do that. We just have to be a little bit smarter and have to be more unpredictable on how you're going to operate and bring those forces together. But it's absolutely essential we do it.
I couldn't agree with you more, sir, and I hope you're right that we've got the capacity still to do it. I'll be talking with other guests in the course of the program about how depleted, notably, the German military is at the moment, but our Navy is still up to the job, I think, but it is going to require some leadership for sure, as well as some additional resources to do that sort of thing. Admiral, let me switch gears quickly because we don't have a lot of time today, I'm sorry to say, but I did want to ask you about the subject of your most recent column in the Canadian Free Press entitled, "The DOJ Has Lost All Credibility." This is a subject on which I am very, very focused at the moment. Tell our listeners about your concerns about the current status of this House IT scandal.
Well, it's atrocious. The plea deal that was reached by the Department of Justice with the Awan leadership is just atrocious. We had a functioning spy ring on Capitol Hill.
When you say we, sir, I think you mean the Pakistanis had a functioning spy ring on Capitol Hill.
But what I find amazing, there hasn't been a peep out of the Speaker of the House. Here he had a spy ring functioning throughout Capitol Hill, and nobody seems to care. We had compromised our security documents. Some of it has special access. The Awan brothers had access to all of the Democratic congressmen who are on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and on the House Intelligence Committee. This is atrocious. What it says in short, Frank, is our counterintelligence program is totally broken. It has to be restarted.
I couldn't agree more, sir. Let me just ask you about the Department of Justice, though, Ace, because you've written about that in your piece as well. It's extraordinary that the Justice Department would accept basically a slap on the wrist and punishment for what seems to be not only a counterintelligence problem of the first order, but theft of government property and heavens knows what kind of exposure to blackmail that they may have been able to bring to bear against these members of Congress for having access to their very sensitive personal and other email and official correspondence.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right, Frank. And it's really atrocious. What it says, in a nutshell, the upper management of the Department of Justice, and that includes the FBI, must be fired. Let me tell you, the House IG, the Department of Justice investigators couldn't find anything wrong when the House Inspector General documented all of these crimes committed by the Awan brothers, including the false purchase of equipment and kickbacks and everything.
We have to leave it at that. Admiral James Ace Lyons, it is so good to talk with you, sir. Your service to the country, as I say, both in uniform and since you retired from the United States Navy, is extraordinary and deeply appreciated. God bless you. Come back to us again, if you would, sir, very soon. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Matthew Kronig right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we are joined by a man I admire greatly. He is Dr. Matthew Kronig, an associate professor at my alma mater, Georgetown University. He is also the deputy director for strategy at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. He is the author of a number of very important books, including A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. He has also just recently authored and published an important new book that we'll be talking about with him in the course of this conversation, The Logic of American Nuclear Strategy. Matt Kronig, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us. It's good to have you back.
Thanks very much for having me on. It's always a pleasure, Frank.
Good. Well, the pleasure's ours. Let me ask you, first of all, we talked a little bit about this with Tom Rogan, but just to get your sense, Matt, of the president's appearance at, performance, some might say, the upshot of all of that at NATO over the past 24 hours or so.
Yes. Well, the president's style is very different from past presidents, but I think the substance of his demands, I think, are pretty consistent. U.S. presidents have complained about NATO not doing enough, other European countries not meeting their defense spending requirements. And so Trump has made that a foremost issue in NATO. And I think he, whether you like the style or not, I think there is evidence that he's getting results, that these countries are increasing their defense spending to try to satisfy Trump. So I think that's one major development. And then in the end, despite the concerns of many, Trump did reaffirm his strong support for NATO. So, the style was rocky, but I think the substance of the outcomes were quite good.
And do you think there will be increases in NATO's defense spending, that is to say the individual member countries' defense expenditures, beyond the 2%? And what do you think is needed, Matt? You've studied closely, and we'll be talking more about some of what the Russians are up to here just a second. But just on this point about NATO, the investments are not for their own sake. They're for the purpose of establishing or reinforcing, at least, deterrence vis-a-vis the Russians, are they not?
Yeah, that's right. We face a renewed Russian threat again, especially since the invasion of Ukraine in 2014. And so once again, we need to have a serious defense policy to protect our neighbors. And on the kind of defense spending, we need just one example, because sometimes people will say, well, we actually don't want NATO countries to build aircraft carriers or nuclear weapons, and that's the point. So, yes, we don't want them to build those capabilities, but there are capabilities that they can build that would support the United States' high-end capabilities to defend Europe. So just one concrete example, we have tanks in Europe. Apparently, I'm told in conversation that the trailers that we usually use don't meet EU regulations for the roads, so we can't use our own trailers. So we use British trailers, but instead of the British giving us the trailers, we actually rent them from Britain. So we're, paying for trailers to put our tanks in Europe to defend Europe. So, things like that, supporting capabilities are the kinds of things that the Europeans should be investing in.
Yeah. I heard Victor Davis Hanson yesterday on Fox decrying the sorry state of the German defense program, not just in terms of the relatively small amount of money that is being spent by the Germans, but the fact that they have very little to show for it in terms of, at least of military kit. I think he actually mentioned that they have 5 aircraft. That seems incomprehensible to me, but the Luftwaffe of old is no more, that's for sure. And I guess this just comes to the question again, and turning to Russia, Matt, of the adequacy of the alliance's deterrent in light of the fact that, as you know so well, the Russians have been greatly investing in their defenses, or as the case may be, offenses, their nuclear forces in particular. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about sort of the Russian doctrine as well as their capabilities at the theater and strategic level that we need to be contending with as we think about our nuclear strategy and requirements.
Yes, well, the risk of nuclear war with Russia, I'm afraid, is higher today than at any time since the end of the Cold War. Not that it's high, I wouldn't want to exaggerate it, but there is a real risk, again, for the first time in 25 years. So Russia is relying more on nuclear weapons in its strategy. It has this idea of de-escalatory nuclear strikes, that basically if they get into a conflict with NATO, that rather than lose that conflict, they would use nuclear weapons relatively early to try to frighten NATO into backing down. And they're building capabilities to support this offensive nuclear strategy. So modernizing strategic forces, but also maintaining their theater nuclear weapons from the Cold War. So torpedoes, depth charges, things that we have long since gotten rid of. and they're building new capabilities in this space. So it's a real threat. And even if they don't use nuclear weapons, it's a problem because they can use the threat of nuclear use for day-to-day coercion. And we've seen that in the Ukrainian crisis and in other episodes over the past couple of years. So, again, it's a real problem, and we need to do more to strengthen our deterrent against it.
I couldn't agree more. Matt Cronin, this morning the president was asked in his press conference about whether he would be taking up some of these issues, nuclear issues, arms control issues, specifically violations by the Russians of their arms control commitments in the course of his conversation with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki next Monday. He has said he would. Tell us a little bit about the context for such conversations if they do take place. What do we know about the degree to which the Russians are now building nuclear capacity well beyond what they're supposed to have, I believe, under both START and the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty?
Yes, the of most concern is the INF Treaty, from my point of view. So this was a treaty signed in 1987 to eliminate all intermediate range ground-based nuclear armed missiles from Europe. So it helped to provide peace and stability in Europe for several decades. And now the Russians are cheating on that. They've built and deployed intermediate range ground launched nuclear armed missiles. So this is a real problem. The United States has been trying to figure out how to respond for some time. So at a minimum, we need to call for Russia to come back into compliance with the treaty, although I don't have very much hope that they will. And so if that's the case, then the United States needs to conduct research and development into its own capabilities in this space to show Russia that there will be a cost for violation, and to ensure that we have the ability to respond to the threat that this poses. On New START, according to the most recent numbers, Russia is in compliance with New START. So New START was a treaty negotiated in 2010 under the Obama administration, according to which Russia and the United States would deploy no more than 1,550 strategic deployed warheads. My concern, though, is that Russia has the capacity to deploy many more than that, and they've maintained the underlying nuclear enterprise in a way that we just haven't. So, New START is really the only treaty that they're still in compliance with, and so if they decide to tear that up like they have with past arms control agreements or violate it, I think we would be in a disadvantageous position.
Just on the INF business, Matt, as you may know, I was involved in the negotiation of that treaty and was very concerned about the fact that I thought it would be violated by the then Soviet Union, now Russia. And the reason that that's so concerning, as you said, is that we have no capabilities at all in this intermediate range force category, certainly deployed in Europe or in for that matter, in Asia. So as the Russians are now violating the treaty and putting back into place some of the kinds of capabilities, if not exactly the same, the kinds of capabilities of a certain range that they were supposed to be eliminating altogether, it does create a disparity. And it seems to me we got to go beyond research and development, my friend. I think we've got to be deploying countermeasures that are comparable, much as we did under President Reagan in the 1980s. Let me turn to one last thing, Matt, before we have to let you go. The Iranian situation has changed dramatically since you wrote your book, A Time to Attack, the Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat, back in 2014, not least because of this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and all that went with it that the Obama administration negotiated with the Iranians and others, and then the withdrawal from it by the president, and now some rather remarkable turmoil inside Iran, in part, I think, because of that withdrawal and the reimposition of sanctions. Talk about whether we are still confronting a need to attack Iran as you see it, or what you would recommend the president do at the moment.
Yes, well, it's an important issue. And my recommendation in the book was that if we can solve the Iranian nuclear crisis through other means, that would be wonderful. But I saw us reaching a point where we may face a choice between living with a nuclear-armed Iran or taking military action to stop Iran's program. And I argued that when we face that choice, that a military strike would be less bad than living with a nuclear-armed Iran and the threat that that would pose. So currently, I believe the Trump plan B for dealing with this is to increase the pressure on Iran. The administration has said they'll put the toughest sanctions in history on Iran, and they've already begun laying the groundwork for that, aiming to cut off Iranian oil exports to zero by November. And then the hope is to bring Iran back to the negotiating table to negotiate a better deal that actually solves this problem. So I hope that that will work, although it will be difficult. So, yes, I do think there is a danger that our diplomatic efforts will fail, that Iran will ramp up its nuclear program, and we may face that difficult choice, and talk of military action, I think, will be back on the table if that happens.
Well, we will be following it closely, as I know will you, Matt Kronig, from your vantage point at the Scowcroft Center, as well as Georgetown University. Thanks, Matt. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Andy McCarthy right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by the great, and I really mean it, great Andy McCarthy, a star now of stage as well as screen. He is seen on the Fox News Network now as a regular contributor. He is an author of numerous extraordinarily important books on various topics relating to our national security and the law. He is, including, among others, my favorite, The Grand Jihad. He is a regular contributor to both PJ Media and National Review. How he finds time for all of this, I have no idea, but I'm very grateful to him for taking a few minutes to talk with us. It's been too long. Good to have you back, Andy. Welcome.
Great to be back, Frank.
We're speaking to you, of course, amidst the latest drama with respect to some of the characters that have emerged on the national scene as, well, agents, shall we say, not just of the FBI, but of a drama that seemed to have had as its purpose both the exoneration of Hillary Clinton for her email scandal and the fabrication and prosecution of Donald Trump for what I think is unfounded case of collusion. Give us your current reading on the Strzok, Page, Rubenstein, Comey, Mueller affair.
Well, Frank, it's hard to gauge what the current state of play is because there's so much more that we don't know than that we do know. But I think we can draw some reasonable inferences. For example, the fact that if special counsel Robert Mueller, who's now been on the job investigating for close to a year and a half, he had a collusion case, which collusion is a weasel word. I think what we're talking about, or should be as prosecutors, is conspiracy to commit some kind of an espionage offense. We would have seen that by now. We have a few people who had connections with Russians, like Papadopoulos, like Flynn, who admitted to having contact with them. And yet when Mueller took guilty pleas, he took pleas to minor charges, like not being truthful in interviews with the FBI, clearly, if he had a collusion case, he would have had them plead guilty to that and explain what the other conspirators in the conspiracy had done. So I'm pretty confident that there's no collusion case, but we really don't know everything that Mueller is doing. It's hard to make a calculation about where Congress's investigation of the investigators is because there's been so much information that's been withheld from the investigating committees. And the investigation, the information that they have been given, a lot of it is classified and can't be discussed publicly. So I think where we're at is Congress is plodding along trying to investigate this. Congressional hearings are not really ideal for this kind of an investigation. They're not really designed for it. Having a forum where you get three dozen congressmen like we're going to have today when Special Agent Peter Strzok of the FBI testifies publicly, having three dozen members of Congress given 5 minutes to conduct rounds of what was supposed to be questioning, but often turns out to be speechifying instead, is not really well designed to do anything else other than make political points. And I think we're really at the point where we have to wait until we get more information in the way of the either filing of a report or filing more charges by Mueller and the filing of final reports by these congressional committees.
Well, that's not terribly satisfying, but I think you're right. It's in the nature of these things. But Andy, one of the folks who has come to particular notorious prominence in all of this is Rob Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Could you just give us a sort of an objective assessment of the role that he's played thus far on the Mueller investigation, for one thing, on the various scandalous doings at the FBI, and not least on the seeming determination on his part to impede the congressional investigations of which you just spoke?
I think, Frank, that you can say for Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein for sure that he made the most consequential decision that's been made in connection with any of these investigations, and that is the decision to appoint Robert Mueller as special counsel, which, as I understand it, he did not consult with anyone else in the Trump administration about, and which, in my view, he did outside, that is, not in compliance with the regulations that apply to the Justice Department when a special counsel is appointed. He's been very close to the vest, to say the least, about what the special counsel has authority to investigate. And he has presided over the Justice Department during a period of time when the congressional committees have complained, I think with great force, that information about the operations of the Justice Department, particularly and the FBI, in these investigations that bore on the 2016 election, that information has not been forthcoming from those agencies. On the other hand, I think he pretty forcefully endorsed the Inspector General report of misconduct in connection by the FBI in connection with the Hillary Clinton investigation. He has encouraged, he says, the internal investigation at the FBI, and he claims that congressional investigations, even though he is not forthcoming as the congressional investigators would like, at the same time, Rosenstein has said that in connection with Devin Nunes' committee's investigation of the origination of the Trump-Russia investigation, he has arranged for a briefing by the FBI into that matter. And it seems that Chairman Nunes has been fairly satisfied with that. You may recall that about a week ago, Nunes threatened that if there wasn't compliance, that he was going to start holding people in contempt, or at least starting to move forward with that. And suddenly that's gone. The reason, evidently, that it has gone silent is that they've become more forthcoming with the information.
Well, let's hope so. You used an interesting turn of phrase. You said that they were complaining about this with great force. It seems to me with great reason as well. They have been frustrated, it seems, at most turns, if not every one. Andy, let me quickly turn, before we run out of time with you, to this issue of Mike Flynn. There is a hearing, I believe, today. As we're speaking, of course, these things, the Strzok testimony, the Flynn hearing, are still in prospect. But as this program airs, they will have been accomplished. But there has been some hope on the part of those of us who are admirers of Mike Flynn that his guilty plea might be vacated and his long, you know, travail over. You have written, I believe, at National Review that that's not likely to be the case. Tell us why.
Yeah, I think it's highly unlikely, Frank. First of all, he hasn't moved to get his plea back. It's not like a court is actually going to just give him his plea back. We don't know if information that should have been disclosed to him before the plea was not disclosed. He has a cooperation agreement with the special counsel, but what I've tried to remind people is that were he to get his plea back, that does not mean the case would go away or that special counsel Mueller's investigation would go away. It would mean he'd be opening himself up to a broad range of potential charges and very litigation, which the avoidance of which was precisely what motivated him to plead guilty in the first place. So I think that, you know, just because very frequently, just because there may be legal grounds to vacate a plea doesn't mean the person will actually want the plea back, because he may decide that what's on the other side of the door is actually worse.
Yeah, understood. Lastly, Andy McCarthy, let me ask you about the president's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh as the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. What are your thoughts on both the man and his credentials for this position, and the rather virulent criticism being hurled his way now by his political opponents?
I think, Frank, if the worst thing they can say about him is he spent too much on baseball tickets, that's a pretty good indication that they've got nothing.
you're not going to hold that against him, that's for sure.
Right. I think he's a stellar judge. He'll be a terrific addition to the court, and I'm delighted with the choice.
And do you fear that there is in his record, his rather copious record, something that might prove his undoing? Or do you think at this point we would have found out about it before now, and that this is much Sturm und Drang, but not going to amount to much in a practical matter in terms of his prospects for confirmation?
Oh, I think he'll be. I think the reason there's even a question about his confirmation is just the close division of the Senate and the fact that the Democrats are approaching this as a political fight rather than a legal issue. But I think he's superb. He's probably the most affirmed appellate judge in the United States, and some of his opinions have actually been adopted by the Supreme Court. And this is a judge who, before compiling that record, was actually approved by the Senate by a 21 vote margin to get onto the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia.
On which he has served with distinction for 12 years. Yeah. Well, from your lips to God's ears, my friend, I hope that's true, as I hope all of your good wise counsel is heeded on so many points. Andy McCarthy, thank you for joining us and for the great work you're doing these days now at Fox News, as well as National Review and PJ Media. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you will come back to us again very soon.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being just about every week, by David Goldman, an extraordinarily impressive intellect and author and columnist, notably under the pseudonym Spengler at Asia Times. David is also the author of How Civilizations Die, and a great resource, particularly on matters involving economics and finance and how they play into our national security interests. David, it's good to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a privilege, Frank. Thanks for the kind words.
My pleasure. Let me ask you, David, about sort of your take on the Trump effect, shall we say, at NATO, whether there was one, in connection in particular with this idea that nations of that organization, that alliance, need to step up and do more with respect to defense spending. Is it something of a breakthrough, as the president has claimed, or not much of a difference from what it was planning on doing anyway?
I think the president was completely right to grab the Europeans by the lapels and shake them hard, because what they're doing is a complete joke. Germany now has exactly 4 combat-ready aircraft out of their 128 fighter planes. Their German brigade, which is supposed to lead the NATO Rapid Response Force, is supposed to have 44 tanks. It has 9. They've starved their military to death. They keep promising to raise their expenditures to 2%. They've been dragging their feet. The defense minister goes to parliament and begs for money, and they say, we don't have any. So it's all a scam on the part of the Europeans. They're pacifists. They don't want to fight. They're rolling over for the Russians and natural gas, exactly as the president said. So he tried to shock them by saying, well, forget 2%. Let's all go to 4% of GDP for defense spending. I'm glad he did it, but I'm a little cynical about the likelihood of a positive European response.
Yeah. You know, I must say, I having heard that North Korea had been transformed from a nuclear threat to not a problem anymore, when the president announced that NATO had been transformed from a problem to the strong alliance that we seek within 2 days' time, there seems to be a bit of hyperbole here, but I very much agree with you that I think he's played this masterfully. And as a alumnus of the Reagan administration's efforts to dissuade the Europeans, in fact, to block the Europeans from putting in that second strand of the Siberian gas pipeline, it seems to me that this is an important reprise of that effort by President Trump.
Back then, we were able to do it. It was the Cold War. Now, our levers are relatively limited, unfortunately.
But David, let me ask you about that, because one of the plays that would seem to be possible here would be simply, providing the Europeans with liquefied natural gas, which we have the potential to have in quite an abundance. Is that something that seems to be very much on the minds of, say, the new Europeans, as Don Rumsfeld used to call them, the Poles notably, as an alternative to getting gas from the Russians? What about the rest of Europe?
The attitude that one reads in the German newspapers every day is that the United States is just trying to sell us their more expensive liquefied natural gas when we can buy gas at about 30% less than the Russians. So why should we pay more? And they won't. They'll look at it strictly as a commercial transaction. One has to remember that Gerhard Schröder, who was the predecessor of Angela Merkel as Chancellor of Germany, is now working for Gazprom. He's officially working for Russia on the payroll, making millions of dollars a year, selling gas to his compatriots. So that's considered perfectly acceptable in German politics.
Speaking of German politics and the ethos that as long as it's good for business, it doesn't matter what the national security implications may be, the Germans seem to be in the process of lashing up with another of our adversaries, communist China, by trying to sell them large numbers of German automobiles, which I assume, David, based on everything you've taught me, among others, that will result in the transfer of both technical capabilities as well as manufacturing capacity that will ultimately wind up being very deleterious to the Germans, among others. What do you think?
Well, I think, Li Ka-shing, the premier of China, went to Berlin right after the tariff war began, and he signed a bunch of deals with German auto and chemical companies, which basically give Mercedes, BMW, and Volkswagen the inside track on providing China with most of the 500 million cars it's going to buy in the next 15 to 20 years. China's by far the biggest auto market in the world. General Motors sells more cars there than they do in the United States. And the big Chinese automakers have now created joint ventures with the German companies to do ordinary car production, electric vehicles, self-driving cars. It's a massive commitment on the part of Germany, and it's a way of the Chinese using the Germans as a lever against us and saying, look, if you're going to make trade conditions tougher for us, we've got other people we can work with. And the Germans are happy to roll over for the Chinese because it's good money. As for the technology, they're giving the technology. That's what a joint venture is. They get to sell the cars in return for giving away the technology. And I think that's a good deal for them commercially.
But again, you've been around for a while. You've seen what happens when technology, proprietary technology especially, is transferred to the Chinese. Is there any doubt in your mind that in due course, a considerable percentage of those 500 million cars will in fact be Chinese cars, not only made in China, but made with German technology, expropriated one way or the other by the Chinese and used to cut the Germans out.
Well, eventually, yes. But Germany is a rapidly aging, dwindling population. The only way you can fund the retirement of a dwindling aging population is to accumulate foreign assets, as the Japanese do. And the Chinese are giving them an amenable way to do that. And the Germans are taking the deal. In 50 years, there won't be that many Germans left. What will they care if they dominate automobile technology?
Well, that's a cheery thought. The question may be, what do they care about whether they're still an independent Western nation, too, for that matter? Let me ask you, finally, speaking of one of the threats to German independence and Western character, Turkey. Recep Tayyip Erdogan was prominently featured at the NATO summit. And yet, it seems to me, as we've discussed and as you've contributed to our newest book, Turkey Ally No More, David Goldman, they really don't qualify for a NATO ally. You've also been chronicling the decline of the lira, the Turkish currency. Tie these various strands together for us as to sort of a situation report for us on Turkey.
President Erdogan is a typical third world kleptocrat running an enormously corrupt and incompetent economic regime. There are some good companies in Turkey, a lot of very smart people, so he's had good raw material to work with. But basically, he put massive amounts of credit into the economy, created a bubble in order to buy votes, and now it's coming home to roost. The Turkish stock market's down by half in U.S. dollar terms in the last couple of years. The Turkish lira has gone from 3 to the dollar a couple of years ago to almost 5 to the dollar now, just below. And Erdogan's response is to put his son-in-law in as finance minister, which is the most arrogant thing a leader has done since Caligula made his horse a consul in ancient Rome. So there's a complete collapse of confidence. The Turkish lira is likely to continue in free fall. It's probably going to look like the Latin American currencies during the debt crisis of the early 1980s. And the only good news is that although Turks are going to suffer as a result, this will probably weaken Erdogan's influence, which in a narrow sense is a good thing.
Fascinating stuff, David Goldman. And as you are looking at the trajectory of Turkey, is it likely that what they will wind up doing, the Turks, will be to actually forge an even closer relationship with, say, the Russians and the Chinese and even the Iranians in their desperation to sort of maintain this neo-Ottoman project?
Well, when Turkish assets become cheap enough and they can't borrow from anybody else, the Chinese will come in and buy things up and tell the Turks, well, you are now an economic province of China, effectively. You're the western end of our new Silk Road, our entry point into Europe, and we'll give you the money you need to scrape by in return for buying a very big chunk of your economy.
And other assets, presumably, as well, including ports or airfields or whatever else they want. This is the debt trap prospect, as you've documented elsewhere so often. David Goldman, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say. Thank you for your time today. I hope you will come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.